Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and it's time for Between the Covers. Tonight, we start another story from Timothy Taylor's latest collection. This one will titillate your taste buds as it follows a woman who sets out to buy a small dairy, makers of a cheese so exclusive that few have ever tasted it. In Pope's Own, Gillian Macken has quit a very successful career as a stockbroker to open a cheese shop, and now she's on the verge of an even bigger step. Here is Bridget O'Sullivan reading Pope's Own.
"Well, now," the man from Kinsale said, returning his pint glass to the dark wood bar, "I am to understand you have some knowledge of our brothers." There was a certain insinuation in the Irish cadence, Gillian thought, not that she would take issue. "I have an associate," she began, as neutral as possible. "Do you, then? Check off McGugan." She knew this would get his attention, but that he wouldn't let on. And sure enough, the man from Kinsale scratched the edge of his jaw, silvery with afternoon beard, and murmured, "Ah, well, then McGugan went to Canada, didn't he?" Chekhov said Brothers was the best washed rind semi-soft in existence, although, no offense, I'll believe that when I taste it. He said it was known locally as Pope's Own, that it was a closely guarded secret, and that I might start looking in the Union Hall area. And he also mentioned your name. Well, did he say all those things now? Gillian sipped her Murphy's Stout and decided to play silence. She had just dumped everything she knew on the bar between them, for one thing. But she also guessed there was going to be some peacocking around here before they got down to issues. Sometimes you just had to let the boys dance and jab for a while before they finally surrendered and told you how much, for how many, and when. This wasn't a lot different than 100, 1,000 meetings she'd had with chief financial officers and accountants and brokers and lawyers over the years. Except this was not so much about money as it was about, well, cheese. The barman came over. "Gillian Lacroix? Macken," she said firmly. Her birth name never felt better. "How they found you here, I'll never know," the barman said, and pointed to a cream-colored dial phone at the end of the bar. "I'm staying up the road," Gillian said. "I told one or two people before I left. Will you excuse me?" "Of course," the man from Kinsale said. "Yellow," she said into the transatlantic squelch. It was Tremblay. She turned her back to the man from Kinsale and looked down the length of the paneled room towards the front door. Earlier that morning, the boats had come in, and there had been a slow-motion flurry of people in front of the garage that served as fish processing plant and outdoor market. Gillian caught the tail end of it, bought some monkfish for dinner. By the time she'd walked up the hill to the house she was renting, made some calls and returned, it was like the small fishing port had been evacuated. "How are you making out?" Tremblay asked. He was concerned, she thought, calling at 7:30 in the morning Pacific time. But Gillian's investment advisor had been expressing concern for her behavior ever since the divorce. And just as she had given up correcting his nervous reversion to her legal married name, she was getting more or less used to this from him, too. "Tremblay," she said quietly, "I'm just sitting down with Clooney now." "I'll let you go, but one thing," Tremblay said. "Something McGugan was saying. I think we have ourselves another bidder here." "Over there?" "No, over there in Dublin. He's a businessman. That's all I know." It was bad news. But Gillian rolled with it. Chekhov had described a pristinely beautiful piece of West Cork farmland with a large, well-kept stone house and buildings, cheese-making equipment, knowledgeable staff, and a working herd of dairy cattle. It was a rare, complete package, and another bidder wasn't such a surprise. The call was also well-timed. Gillian calculated that the phone had rung just as Clooney was about to puff himself up with how impossibly exclusive Brothers was, how not just any purchaser would do. Now, as she got off the phone, Clooney would have to take a big breath and start all over again.
Sorry,
she said, sliding onto her stool. Clooney had a little Murphy's Stout cream on the edge of his trim mustache. 50-ish, handsome, in a Tattersall shirt and sport coat way. He had a mess of black Irish hair she thought went nicely with the green-shouldered hills covered in shaggy goats and yellow broom. He opened his mouth to continue. Chekhov says hello, Jillian interrupted. She imagined this like the left hook counter you throw just as your sparring partner telegraphs an overhand right. Does he? Well. Clooney accepted another pint of Murphy's without word or payment. Was that him then? Jillian didn't answer. She watched instead as Clooney's left index finger dipped unconsciously into a vest pocket and withdrew a single bead of a rosary. Why do they call it Pope's Own? A religious man, our Clooney, Chekhov had said. Fanatic? No, just Irish. May I do something? Jillian asked. And then, without waiting for permission, she took a hanky from the sleeve of her sweater and very lightly wiped the Murphys off the tip of Clooney's mustache. She didn't have to look over to know the barman caught that one. Clooney suppressed a blush. It was hard to do, Jillian imagined, but she saw it bloom ever so slightly before being pinched off. I'm sorry, she said again, and in a way she was sorry, although she got the reaction she wanted. She was sorry, perhaps, to have deployed that kind of a feint, even in service of this. Clooney sighed. Tell me about yourself, he said finally. They'll want to know. Nothing to tell, really, Jillian thought. Nothing more than the standard investment banker-turned-quality cheese importer story. Nothing to tell beyond the fact that not a single core feature of her life had survived the preceding two-year period, beyond her sparring partner. You're hitting a bit harder, girl, Maria told her a year before, shortly after the divorce was finalized. Sorry, I feel really loose. Maria temped, and was only in her 20s. They met at the boxercise class Jillian enrolled in before David moved out. She became more interested in the sport after the split. This was not entirely a matter of unresolved hostility, although there was a measure of that. Jillian thought it had more to do with reasserting authority over things, over herself. You were management, Maria said. Like, your own office and everything? What's with cheese? I have to ask. Jillian looked at her younger friend. She felt sisterly, and she wondered a whole range of things in a single instant that seemed to wind up at the question, what suburban jerk was Maria dating at the moment? You know, Jillian said, it just became really important to be in charge of my whole day. From morning to night, I answer to me. Well, sure, Maria said, hands up like, you don't need to explain that. But you're going to stay interested selling people mozzarella? Selling anything I can actually touch and smell, said Jillian. She might have added, anything the existence of which I can myself verify. But this was the harder part to explain to Maria. David being gone was more than a hole in her life. He made a blank spot she could not be sure had ever been full. The piece he removed came out of her present, and by transfiguring himself utterly, by rendering himself unknowable, David had expunged himself from the past as well. The operative word for the future became tangibility. There was a period of chasmic anxiety attacks, but these eventually subsided and were replaced by the conviction that she must do something with her hands, something real and unimpeachably good. She quit her job. She cashed in the West Vancouver house and bought a tiny condo downtown and a piece of land up the valley with good outbuildings. She sourced the cattle, specced milking and cheese-making equipment, then ran into the administrative blockade known otherwise as the Milk Board. It seemed the cheese manufacturing industry in Canada, presumably while nobody was looking, had been tapped down hard under a grid of quotas and regulations, and you pretty much had to commit civil disobedience to make and sell a batch of unpasteurized cow's milk Camembert. She was forced to give up the whole idea, the closest to depression she had come through the entire preceding 6 months. Then her therapist found out through circuitous connections about Ye Old Cheese Shop. 30 years in the business, and Mr. Brian Chekhov McGugan was finally hanging up the slicer. A little dusty, perhaps, a little prone to stodgy Stiltons in ceramic vases. But McGugan's was situated, nevertheless, on a busy corner in fashionable Point Grey. Jillian thought Martha Stewart would buy cheese here if the place were redecorated to look like Dean and DeLuca's, and if everything were expensive enough. Her therapist was thrilled. It's really great to be able to help. I mean, really help. Jillian closed the deal with McGugan personally. It tapped her out, cash-wise. She had literally nothing left, but she was no longer in therapy, and standing in front of the Jillian Mackin Fine Cheese sign, copper plate lettering on a farm green background, Jillian thought she might never have been so aware of the potential for fulfillment. "Hardly recognize the place," Chekhov McGugan said, on hand at the opening. "It's all the customers," she said, bantering in the way they had adopted. And it was true. Business was good, even without David's strained patronage. He was apparently selling more paintings a month now than he had sold in the 6 years they were married. Paintings of the model he had been sleeping with, no less. And he was compensating by buying more cheese a month than he consumed in the same period. The facile selfishness of his quest for absolution notwithstanding, Jillian was grateful that he bought the expensive stuff. Le Cru Pont l'Evêque, an appellation-controlled Bleu de Gex that had to be coaxed out of a supplier in the Haute-Jura. Even the handmade Gorgonzola Brie Cross from the farm in upstate New York owned by Wolfgang Puck, that came in at $67 a kilo without much margin. "I wouldn't bother with that one if I were you."
"Why not?"
"Well, it's a bit of a fake cheese, isn't it? Gorgonzola Brie. You'll be selling Cambonzola next."
"I am selling Cambonzola, Chekhov. Quite a lot of it, actually."
"Ever hear of farm cheese? Real, small-batch stuff? Comes alive in your mouth? These friends of yours would pay whatever you ask for it."
The last time she saw David, he said, "Anything I can do for you here, I want you to ask."
"Well, thanks," Jillian said. "I mean it. Things are good for me." He tried not to look too pleased.
"New York and everything. I know you don't need money.
I need," Jillian said,
"for you not to come here anymore." It left her short of breath to have finally said it, but there was no doubt. She caught him coming in.
David's face went dreamy and confused. He said, clutching his paper bag full of expensive cheese as if that might hold him up. She stared at him and waited. There was simply no goddamn way she was obliged to explain herself. Bleed.
"Don't be angry," Chekhov said later. "For yourself, don't be angry."
So that was the end of David. But it didn't matter anyway, she thought, because by then she had been given a nice write-up in a local food magazine, and business was ticking along. It took a year to lay down the base, but Jillian Mackin Fine Cheese prospered and even began to pay Jillian Mackin a salary, which she used to hire Maria. And then it happened. A Thursday, she remembered. About a year and a half in, she was checking a delivery from the warehouse in France. Maria was up front. It was a good delivery, an overdue delivery. Jillian was standing with her clipboard, marking off all the colorful packages and boxes that she'd pulled together from master cheesemakers in the Jura, the Haute Savoie in Normandy and Paris. Wheels upon wheels that she and Maria would now cut down to portions and sell inside 4 weeks. She could even pick who for what. Who for the Crottin de Chavignol? Who for the downy, soft-rounded Coulommiers? Who for the serious discs of Reblochon? She imagined the pride of each of these cheesemakers and the certain pleasure of each of her many customers, a pleasure she had facilitated. The cheese
midwife. The thought filled her with a sudden sweeping anxiety she had not felt in some time. To think of all these exquisite creations that she purchased and sold, that passed through her hands more or less unaffected, and which were then greedily consumed and gone from her forever. "Anything the existence of which I can myself verify," she thought. Her first impulse had been right. To bring to life herself, that was verification, that was tangibility. And here she had been once again deflected, just as she had been during all her time with David, shunted to the banal and selfless periphery of the creative process. Maria said, "Take a break already. You ever go to a Club Med?"
Bridget O'Sullivan is reading from Pope's Own by Timothy Taylor. Tomorrow, Jillian is brought to the farm's secret location. This is the time of year when many of us throw away the calorie counters and indulge our appetite for rich food, at least for a little while. Here's one Yuletide treat that won't add an ounce. Helen Maria Williams' poem, To Mrs. K, on her sending me an English Christmas plum cake at Paris. It's a celebration of fruitcake and friendship, and it's read by Donna Goodhand.
To Mrs. K, on her sending me an English Christmas plum cake at Paris. What crowding thoughts around me wake, what marvels in a Christmas cake. Ah, say, what strange enchantment dwells enclosed within its odorous cells. Is there no small magician bound and crusted in its snowy round? For magic surely lurks in this, a cake that tells of vanished bliss. A cake that conjures up to view the early scenes when life was new, when memory knew no sorrows past, and hope believed in joys that last. Mysterious cake, whose folds contain life's calendar of bliss and pain, that speaks of friends forever fled, and wakes the tears I love to shed. Oft shall I breathe her cherished name, from whose fair hand the offering came, for she recalls the artless smile of nymphs that deck my native isle, of beauty that we love to trace, allied with tender, modest grace, of those who, while abroad they roam, retain each charm that gladdens home, and whose dear friendships can impart a Christmas banquet for the heart.
To Mrs. K, on her sending me an English Christmas plum cake at Paris. A poem written by the 18th century British writer Helen Maria Williams and read by Donna Goodhand. We found that poem in the anthology Women Romantic Poets, published by Everyman's Library. And that's our program for this evening. If you'd like to write to us, we can be reached at Between the Covers, P.O. Box 4600, Vancouver, B.C., V6B4A2. Our email address is btc@vancouver.cbc.ca. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights.